This program was recorded on May 16. Therefore, late-breaking developments regarding this evening's topic may not be reflected in this discussion.
Good evening. My name is Paul Edwards, and I'm in Miami, Florida. Welcome to Tuesday Topics. I'd like to begin by thanking Marlena for doing the recording and thanking whoever in the ACB radio team ends up having the joy of editing tonight's program. I'd also like to express my appreciation to all of the folks who've turned up tonight to talk about a topic that was not previously scheduled, but that we've put on the agenda because it's become kind of a hot topic in the blindness community, and that topic is Web Braille. And of course, I want to thank Talking Communities and George Buys for making this software available to us that allows us to do this program. Web Braille is a system that the National Library Service started in 1998, and it is a system that stores copies of Braille volumes that are produced for the hard copy Braille collection of NLS and can be downloaded by individuals who are eligible to do so. These individuals must be certified by their regional library, are issued a username and password, and only when they have signed on with their username and password are they actually able to download these volumes, which were originally designed either to be printed in Braille or to be used with Braille displays. The reason for the username and the password has to do with copyright protection, because the current copyright law essentially says that only an organization which has the right to put such materials into print, is a nonprofit entity and so on, can put up such a collection, and only individuals who are duly certified as print disabled can access it. So on our program this evening, we have a number of people, some of whom are Web Braille users and some of them who are not, who will be talking with us a little bit about Web Braille. While we are all concerned that Web Braille is down, I think there are some broader issues that are involved in the current controversy over Web Braille, which will probably have some spillover into a wider range of things, including, by the way, the emerging technology for digital talking books. So while we will be talking with our focus on Web Braille, we'll also be talking a good deal about a term which we had best understand from the ground up, and this term is digital rights management. Digital rights management is the term that's used to describe the way that a file is protected so that it can't be utilized by a person who isn't eligible to use it, and can't be used in ways that the person who is eligible to use it might want to, but which shouldn't be used that way. That's a little unclear, but I think as the evening goes on, it'll be clearer. It's similar to copyright protection. Copyright protection, of course, is kind of an empty exercise in that, we'll come back to some of that, but digital rights actually does, in the case of other ebooks, those notably produced by places like Microsoft and Adobe, does actually have built into it some protections that causes the file to behave in certain ways and that won't allow you to do certain things with that file. So much for an introduction. We have quite a bunch of people here, and I actually know of many of the folks here. And for the first part of the program, I'm going to pick on people and ask them some pretty specific questions. And I may be coming kind of out of left field in terms of that. But I'm going to start with Marlena Lieberg from the state of Washington, who is a Web Braille user. And I'd like Marlena, if she could, to kind of describe how she got started using Web Braille and also to tell us a little bit about how the system works, if you would, Marlena.
How I got started using Web Braille. I've been using it so much that, if I can remember back, I'd certainly heard about Web Braille on many fronts, and when it became available, I contacted my librarian out here in Seattle and said, I want to sign up for this thing. I don't know what it is, but I want to sign up for it. And so I was issued my username and password. And the way in which I initially started using Web Braille is was that I would look at the Braille hard copy of Braille Book Review and say, ah, I'd like that book, and then go on to the Web Braille site and do a search and find the book. And it took a lot of time, but it was very well worth it for me. However, I soon discovered that the Braille Book Review, of course, is online, and that one could have links right to the books that one wanted. So if I only use the Braille Book Review, that's how I would get my books. The interface, you go to the NLS website, the Web Braille site. You sign in with your username and password, and then it's just set up like a typical, very accessible web page, and you navigate through it as you would through any page that you're dealing with on the web.
Thanks very much. That's a pretty good description. Let me do one other follow-up question with you. Have you made any effort to use Web Braille through the online catalog interface that's also available on that site?
Oh, yes, I have. And again, it's standard controls. You can key in your author or your title or your keywords. And frequently, one of my favorite things to download from Web Braille, I was changing its name to Wed Braille, Web Braille, are cookbooks, because Braille is so huge that I've never had a collection, and now I have quite a collection of them. And so frequently using the keyword feature I find very helpful as well.
And using the online catalog, you can actually select for subjects, and you can select for authors, and do a whole range of things that actually allows you to find all the books that are available in Web Braille that you can then download. Web Braille began then as a collection of NLS-produced books. A number of regional libraries, Florida I know has, Iowa I know has, and I noticed the other day another state that I hadn't realized was there, and I don't remember what it is, have also begun to contribute some Web Braille titles, or some Braille titles that they actually transcribed locally, and that have passed muster and have gone up as Web Braille titles. So the last time I talked with Judy about numbers, I think we were about to 5,000 Web Braille titles. Web Braille at the moment is not functioning, and there is no clear and unequivocal answer that I've heard that explains why it isn't functioning. There are lots of stories out there, but it certainly appears that one of the factors that is leading Web Braille to be unavailable right now is that NLS has some concerns about the digital rights management issue. And please let me hasten to say that I am inferring that this is the case. I have no direct evidence, and I am making no accusations. In fact, accusations is not the purpose of this program. The purpose of this program is to try to put the issue out on the table so that people will understand that it actually is an issue. If the only way that you could access Web Braille books was using a Braille display, I don't think that Web Braille would be down now, and I don't think that anybody would regard it as an issue. But in fact, it is probably true that there are many more people using Web Braille than those who have Braille displays. Just for the heck of it, I don't think there are any, but let me ask if there is anyone here who is using Web Braille with a device other than a Braille display, i.e. reading Web Braille with speech.
Well, Paul, I'm going to jump in for 1 second because I'm in both camps. Having had surgery on both my hands, my hands cannot physically stay pointed in the position they need to be pointed in order to accurately read Braille for probably more than 10 or 15 Braille pages max. So while I always start out with my Braille display, I certainly do use other means, and I'll hold off and wait till you lead the conversation to those means.
I don't know what's wrong with my computer tonight, and I should just say to listeners, even on the edited version, you're probably going to hear some choppiness from me because for some reason my computer connection is dropping in and out all over the place. Now that she's had surgery on her hands, she's had to resort to speech. And one of the ways that you can do that is by simply using the speech component in the note taker that you have, so that if Marlena was downloading to a Braille note, and I would assume that she is, or if I were downloading to a Braille Lite or a PK, it would then be possible for me to turn speech on and listen to that file just as if I were reading from a text file on a computer. That's true because all of the note takers have a built-in back translator that operates in the speech mode. So the one of the very first things that happened, and by the way, a person who has a type and speak or a Braille and speak who can turn grade 2 translation on but doesn't have a Braille display has just as much access to Web Braille books as I do or as Marlena does. So initially, even from the inception of Web Braille, there were some very easy ways of listening to books using synthetic speech. And in fact, it wasn't a large issue. A little further down the line, two entities came into the Web Braille picture, which radically changed things again. And these two companies were Kurzweil and Freedom Scientific, who both built in to the scanning programs that they sell an ability to download books from Web Braille. And when you download books from Web Braille and put them into these devices, they are also readable with speech. So we suddenly went from kind of exceptions to a much broader population who suddenly had access to Web Braille because they had bought scanning programs like Open Book or the Kurzweil 1000. And then came a third element, and this was the introduction of, well, it began with a very primitive device, which was still pretty cool, but then became the Bookport and the Book Courier. And both of these are also able, using built-in speech synthesizers, to read Web Braille files just fine. And they use DoubleTalk, which is the same synthesizer that's used in the Braille Lite. So all of these devices were actually able to read using synthesizers, essentially any Web Braille title. So that is part of the answer to a question that was asked before. How can you read or use Web Braille books without having a Braille display? But we go further. I wonder if anyone here is actually using Web Braille through any of these scanning programs before I start talking about them.
Yes, Paul, I'm using Web Braille through Kurzweil 1000, and with the good synthetic speech that is available through K1000, it's comfortable to read. However, and I may be jumping ahead, so I'll just say this and then stop. As I'm currently reading a book with a fair amount of, which isn't Web Braille, but it is a BRF book, with a fair number of accented French words, the translation for the accented words is startling and not comfortable. So, but yes, I'm using Kurzweil.
Mm-hmm. Well, I thought you might have decided to go where I wanted to go next. Again, continuing to lay the groundwork for an understanding of how complex this issue actually becomes. Because the next thing to hit the scene were MP3 players. By the way, the Bookport and the Book Courier are MP3 players themselves, and perhaps it was Bookport and Book Courier people themselves who started doing this. Perhaps it was Perhaps it was Kurzweil users. But the fact is that with Kurzweil, you can use their high-quality synthetic speech and in the background, while you're doing other things, create MP3 files of whatever it is you're reading. Now, these files tend to be pretty large, especially if you choose an intermediate quality. But the cool thing is you can set it to a speed at which you're comfortable. You can set it to a pitch at which you're comfortable. And then what makes things interesting is those MP3 files are then usable on an MP3 player, an MP3 player right out of a store, an iPod, or an MP3 player that uses CDs that you can burn and, in theory, make those MP3 CDs available to everyone in the whole world. And this is where digital rights management becomes an issue. Because while there is certainly permission to put Braille books up there, it's decidedly a question as to whether it's appropriate to put audiobooks up there. And if it is as easy as it is to turn a web Braille book into an audiobook that is readable using a conventional CD player, does NLS have something to worry about? Let me throw that question out and see what people think.
Yeah, this is Bob. I would say the Kurzweil, and I don't know, I have Kurzweil of a couple of versions going. I guess I don't think the speech is all that high quality. I have it at work. But it is synthesized speech, and I question how marketable that is. And if the worry is they're going to sell this stuff out in the market and violate copyright and all that stuff, is this stuff marketable? I'm not sure, but I doubt it. And I think it's only us blind folks that use synthesized speech to listen to books and things.
Hello, this is Gary Wood from Lansing, Michigan. Yeah, I can see that if there's that concern of being people marketing this stuff that they would be burning from their collections. And it sounds to me like that the people that NLS is really concerned about copyright and digital rights management. I think that that's what's and just my opinion, that's what's causing them to run scared about this web Braille and anything else, probably even digital talking books and all that they're being concerned about.
I would agree, because if you've ever, I was trying to one time with some sighted people teach them how to use a type and speak, and they couldn't stand to listen to that speech. Now, I know the speech from Kurzweil is better, but I just couldn't imagine the average person listening to something like that. I just don't think that they would want to.
Don Moore from Port Charlotte. I think that right now, I agree that the speech isn't good enough to be commercially available. However, speech improves, and in not a real long time, we will be having probably human-quality speech on our machines and available for reading. And even if it weren't, lawyers being lawyers and the courts being as uncertain as they are and everybody panicking over that stuff, there's probably a reason that if this is the case, why NLS is taking this position. I think that if it were explained a little better, then we might not have had the issues that we're having now where everybody's kind of running off in a panic.
I think that the quality of speech, this is Doug in Daytona, I think the quality of speech is not the real issue. The issue, I believe, is that by federal regulations, talking books must be in a format that is only accessible to people who are eligible for talking books. And as Paul said, what can be done now subverts some of those regulations that we have to work under.
Like someone else said, if this was all told to us a little bit more clearly, and the other thing, just to shut it down the way they did, it is my understanding from talking to folks in and outside of various libraries that there's no evidence of any violations at this point. So without the violations, I don't see why they couldn't have left the service open while, you know, doing something, you know, on the side. I mean, if they told us we're going to get an encryption key and we're waiting to do that, then, well, hey, that's fine. I think a lot of us probably wouldn't have maybe ran out and signed that petition the way we did. But the way they handled it in some respects to me is almost as bad, if not as bad, as what they did.
I want to bring it back to Paul's question about is it marketable? I think that was your question. For outside of the qualified users. And I have to tell you guys that the speech, and I'm blanking, it's been a long day, and I can't think of anything precisely that I'm trying to say here tonight, but the synthesizers, the Kate and Michael voices, are incredibly humanoid voices in Kurzweil. So much so that when I get people who want to have one of our state affiliate newsline issues, and they're new members, I just have Kate read it and burn a CD of it. And it ain't perfect, but boy, oh boy, I'm going to say 90% there. So I do think whoever said the speech technology is only going to improve is absolutely right. But I also think Doug is right that the issue is that we've always gotten our books on four-track cassette, which is not commercially playable, and then we had our records recorded at whatever speed they were, 33 and some two-thirds, or I don't remember what it was. But anyway, so I think that's more the issue.
Well, I think that I read somewhere today, but it's because I've been a little behind in my emails, that making copies of cassette books or onto disc or anything is kind of unwieldy. But with the digital technology, it's almost instantaneous. And I think that the problems, like with Marlena saying about the quality of speech improving greatly, I think that could be a concern of nervousness about the marketability of such things. And that might be a big issue.
Well, there is also the issue, Paul, I think, of Bookshare. You know, we're not just talking about NLS. This is Bonnie from Ohio. Bookshare certainly is another place in which people could take books, put them on MP3s and that kind of thing. And I know that even though there is a fee for that, that probably is also another issue. I know that gets away from NLS, but it's another thing to consider.
Well, what they could do is take them and convert them to text and put them up there.
Well, actually, Bonnie, your discussion of Bookshare is a pretty legitimate issue, because their approach to protection is essentially the same as NLS's, except that they indicate that they do digitally fingerprint every download. Now, precisely what that means, I don't think any of us who are not technologically savvy have a clue, which means that they claim in their blurb that they can actually identify an individual who downloaded a given book that may turn up in the wrong hands, and that if that were to happen, they could take action to shut that person down so as not to damage the viability of the whole system. And one of the other reasons why Bookshare is relevant is that they certainly are competition. They certainly complement NLS and certainly make a range of books available. I know that I would be suffering far greater withdrawal symptoms were it not for the fact that Bookshare is still up and running and has not disappeared. We should also say, by the way, that there is a broad range of approaches being taken to digital rights management, depending on where you are and who's doing the managing across the board. RFB&D is taking a very careful, in fact, some of us would argue a too careful approach to digital rights management. Canada, in their library, isn't exercising any at all.
And if you use NetLibrary, they're very, very heavily DRM'd, and they, if you, I made a mistake and downloaded a book. I have two different computers, and I made a mistake and downloaded a book on the computer that I use for business, which is not attached to an FM transmitter, and I could not play that book on my other computer, even though I was the very same person. You know, I had the same ID for the book and everything. I couldn't play it, nor could I re-download that same book for 21 days, even on the other computer. And if you play the book in Windows Media, when you play the book in Windows Media, the only way that you can record the book is if you run a secondary recording program, which means you have to play the whole book and that computer is dedicated strictly to that. And who the heck is going to bother with that?
Yeah, I've seen that too, how the Net Library works, because I've done that before.
The point, though, that gets made and that we begin to note is that digital rights management isn't an issue only for people who are blind. There are other people who are downloading books from Net Library, and there are a couple of competitors to Net Library up there. And it might be a good idea for us to talk for a moment about what the approach of places like Net Library is, because it's an entirely different approach than the one that's taken by either WebRail or Bookshare. Liz, would either you or Marlena like to talk about how Net Library works and what happens when you download a book?
All right. First of all, you have to present your library card, which is, you know, meaning credentials, that you, you know, do have a library account and you can benefit from having those books. The second thing is that you go on to the Net Library website and you sign into your particular, you know, library area, and then you can search for audiobook. You can download the audiobook onto your computer. That's in a Windows audio file, which is pretty large. That means you can't put it on a CD or anything. And you cannot have a second download of the book until 21 days is over. I think it sends a cookie or something to you, the place that your computer's already gotten the book. Because I tried it. I accidentally did one once, like Marlena did, on the computer I didn't want it on, and was not able to download it for 20 more days. Then you can listen to it, and then I believe that after 20 days, it expires.
That's quite right, and that's the point. So it really is a true library book, and as soon as the length of time that your library has set on the clock has gone by, that file ceases to function. And so that's the way that they protect their digital rights. But they go further than that, because Net Library actually, in effect, sells libraries downloads. And so essentially what that means is that the number of downloads of a given book that can be out at any given moment in time is limited by the amount that the library has been prepared to pay Net Library for that particular title. It isn't anything like the free and relatively unlimited access that we have through WebRail or Bookshare. And on Bookshare, there is a book limit per month, but that limit is 100 books. So most of us actually don't read quite that many a month.
And the other limitation, of course, it's implied, but just to say it clearly, the other limitation with something like Net Library is you are pretty well bound to your computer. Now, you can put the books onto a Moovo or like-type device, but when one has become accustomed to the luxury of access via a book port, a Moovo is like roughing it, you know, with none of the comforts of home. It also says that you can burn your book to CD, but I have not been able to do that. That is always disabled for me. So it really isn't as comfortable and convenient as Bookshare or WebRail.
I would be curious, Paul, and if you don't want to get into this, that's all right, what authors have to say about people getting books on computers and through Bookshare and that kind of thing, because, of course, as with music, this takes away from what they get, even though obviously they're given advances for books they've written and that kind of thing, and it's probably all figured out ahead of time. I'm curious what you might be thinking about that.
It's really been kind of interesting. When the copyright law was initially passed, there were a number of authors who were highly irate, and the same thing was true when Bookshare was started. And in fact, the group of authors that has perhaps been most irate on Bookshare, according to my sources, are the science fiction authors, who of course are pretty cognizant of what can be done with technology. As a group, they're probably further along the technology food chain or higher on the technology food chain than some of the rest of us. And so they were initially very concerned about Bookshare and were very uncomfortable with having their books there and demanded why they weren't asked and on and on and on and on and on. And it became something of an issue for them. The copyright protections are really pretty clear. But before we go too much further, I want to go to a slightly different issue, which again helps to show just how complicated this issue is. I want to ask if anyone has recently scanned a print book and could tell our listeners a little bit about what it says about the electronic use of print books.
I tried it once, and it said that the print books, basically said something about that this was banned and that you weren't supposed to be doing it.
Yes. Essentially, they say we would like to discourage what they described as electronic piracy. Do not scan and upload this title, and only buy legitimate electronic versions of the book. To me, those sentences are very significant. And the reason they're significant is the fact is that anyone, whether that person is blind, whether that person is using a Bookshare book, whether that person is using a Web Braille book, anyone using a print book and a scanner can turn that book into a file, whether it's a PDF file, whether it's a DOC file, whether it's a TXT file, which is infinitely exchangeable on the internet. And there are, in fact, sites where large numbers of new books are stashed away illegally. So I think that the other context that we need to be aware of is that the technology that's available to us isn't restricted to us. Anybody can go out and buy NeoSpeech speech synthesis from the company. Anybody can download Microsoft SAPI 5 synthesizer. Anybody can burn a CD with an MP3 version of any file that they have with shareware or freeware programs that are already on the net. And so the reality is it isn't only blind people who have the ability to distribute to the world at large copies of books. The difference between blind folks is that as long as they are the only ones who are using them, they're not breaking the law. Those who are pirating and distributing to others electronic versions of books are, in fact, breaking the law.
One thing I'd like to throw out along those lines is, and I know that this happens, the blind folks who kind of break that trust, and how that all plays into this. Say the Bookshare user who shares a book with a non-Bookshare user, that kind of thing. And I just wonder if we as blind folks really have almost an obligation to be more cautious or conservative in order to help protect this capability of digitally receiving our reading material. And that may be a whole other Tuesday topics. I don't know, but you can rule me out of order, sir.
I wouldn't want to do that. I think the points that you make are quite relevant. And it's all part of this broader issue that applies not just to publishing for blind folks, but to publishing in general. We're at a stage where the truth is whether authors like to admit it or not, and whether publishers like to admit it or not. They no longer have control over where their books go and how they get there. And interestingly enough, I have not so far seen anybody taken to court for violation of copyright laws for distributing electronic versions of books, though I frankly wouldn't have a problem if somebody were taken to court that way. I value the protection of an author's rights. I mean, one of these days I may actually sit down and write a book, and if I do, I want all the money.
Me too. This is Bonnie. I am hoping at some point to have a book written myself, and so certainly that is a concern. But I wanted to say something about when you were talking, Paul, about the people that this doesn't just involve blind people. I was thinking about all of the groups in our society who really need to have books that are recorded or whatever. For instance, it's my understanding that, say, for example, if you're dyslexic and can't read print or have very difficult time reading print, that you can get books from NLS. Of course, in addition to that, we also have a very large population that cannot read at all, and those are other issues. So these categories keep broadening out more and more as we go on.
Yes, they do, but it's by no means a simple issue. How ought entities like NLS or Bookshare or Recording for the Blind operate, and how should they operate to optimize the ongoing continuation of the willingness of publishers not to go back to Congress and say, we want this copyright law repealed because these guys are misusing it. Is that a real concern? Is that a real issue? Is it a red herring? I don't think that I know, and I'm not sure that any of us know, so at least to a degree, my question was rhetorical. But I think that it is a legitimate and valid responsibility on the part of those people who put materials up there under a provision of the copyright law that at the very least they give the appearance of being concerned about these issues. And so one of the things that this whole shutdown may legitimately have done is it may legitimately have indicated that NLS has taken the time to evaluate the current situation, to take a look at what is now possible, to assess whether things need to be changed, and perhaps change nothing. But having made that assessment, they can go back to publishers and say, look, when these issues were raised publicly, we responded by taking another good hard look at our system. And we found that we, in fact, were fundamentally in compliance and that there was no reason for us to change.
I wanted to raise two points. One is going back to the way in which Web Braille was closed. I'm not sure that I have enough information to say they shouldn't have done it. I'm not sure anyone has enough information. But the manner with which it was handled, I'm disappointed that our cooperating libraries weren't told that that there wasn't a notice put up even on Web Braille that might have said to folks who went there the day before, hey, we've got some technical issues we need to look at, we're going to close, don't panic, whatever. And the second point I wanted to wonder about is if you, Paul, or anyone else here knows much about the Chaffee amendments for the copyright laws and how they may play into all of this.
I think that that the question that was raised concerning the manner in which it was done is a valid and appropriate one. I don't carry any coals to Newcastle for NLS, and while it may seem that I'm sympathetic to NLS, the fact is that I recognize this is a pretty complicated issue, and I'm prepared to give them the benefit of the doubt, and I'm even prepared to invent, perhaps, scenarios that will help to make a situation seem more logical than it in fact might be. But the bottom line is that to simply yank Web Braille suddenly, catastrophically, and immediately, without any significant amount of accompanying explanation that I've seen, certainly appeared to me to be a high-handed and unwarranted and overzealous use of power that almost seemed like a use of power for its own sake.
Yeah, I would think, Paul, that it sounds to me like they were being less than honest, I would say, in the way they went about pulling Web Braille from it without any notice or anything like that.
Well, and again, Gary, we don't know what circumstances caused them to pull Web Braille. What I think we can comment on, and not impeach their motives there, I think we can say that the effect was to create a firestorm. The public relations fallout from the approach that was taken clearly has not been good for NLS, and I think that it's equally accurate to say that to do so with virtually no explanation at all, at least on the face of it, seems an inappropriate and somewhat high-handed way to deal with it.
Do you know, you or anyone else, have any knowledge about the Chaffee amendments dealing with copyright?
Yes, I do, and clearly the Web Braille collection is a Chaffee artifact.
Could you explain that, sir?
Well, Web Braille would not have been legal, nor would Bookshare, or really runnable. Because in the past, individualized permission had to be given for every copyrighted piece of material that was made available in the collection. With the Chaffee amendments, essentially what they say is what I suggested at the beginning of this program. First, a not-for-profit organization which devises appropriate methods for assuring that eligibility to these materials is limited to those people with print disabilities, are allowed now under the Chaffee Amendment to put books there or to produce books, whether they be talking books or whether they be Braille books, without seeking prior permission from the publisher. Essentially, it's a blanket permission. But that blanket permission speaks very much to this issue of specialized formats and limited access to these materials for people who are print disabled.
So many times, I think, Paul, this is Bonnie, that when we begin anything, technology or what we've invented is way ahead of any of the legal necessities that we find we will have as time goes on. I think this has been proven many, many times in things that have been invented and been created. And I think this is just another example of that. When you take this apart and think back to the beginning of Web Braille, I'm sure that people back then, before Bookshare and all of these other things, Book Courier and Bookport and all of the other things we've talked about, those people who did all this had no idea, had no way to anticipate all of the things that would come up and all of the ways in which all of these books would be able to be gotten to and used and utilized. And I think that is really an issue. I think it's just that so many times we just have no idea how much will come about and how much change there will be. And there are factors that people just don't know about in the beginning that they can't really anticipate.
I think you're absolutely right, Bonnie. Let me throw one other thing into the parking lot here. There's another legal concept out there, which is the concept of fair use, which has gotten a lot of discussion over this issue and, frankly, over many other copyright-related issues. And the legal concept of fair use tries to define what it is that it's okay for somebody to do with something. So, for example, if I buy a book, a print book, can I lend that print book to a friend if I choose? Can I give that print book away to a friend if I choose? Can I sell that print book secondhand if I choose? The answer to all of those questions is probably yes. Could I make photocopies of that book and distribute it to 30 students in a classroom?
I've been told that that's not legal.
Me too. It's a violation of the copyright law because it extends beyond fair use. It is fair and appropriate for me to do with that book anything that an individual could be legitimately expected to do with the book. And the question is, does the protection that NLS uses and that Bookshare uses constitute a sufficient level of care that assures that only fair use as defined by the copyright law is in fact allowed and permitted and protected. It seems to me that it does, especially in the context of what I described about what anyone can do with print books. And so as a result, it seems to me if there were an effort to curtail access to Bookshare or Web Braille or other closed entities such as these, we have a very strong argument to suggest that under fair use, to deny us access to this stuff would in fact now be inappropriate, especially since, as someone said earlier, there doesn't appear to be any widespread violation of the rules of Web Braille by those who use it.
I wanted to say, Paul, this is Bonnie again, that I remember reading a number of years ago in Washington Post's Book World an article about e-books and how when companies first started doing e-books, for example, a book that was put out by one company could only be played on one type of technology. And when you brought up the idea of, say, passing print books on to a friend, I thought of this because you couldn't take a book back then and give it to a friend and have them go home and play it on their computer because the technology only worked with whatever hardware that particular company had used in making the book, and you couldn't transfer it to somebody else. It was impossible. So they did try.
And for the most part, Bonnie, you can't now. This is beyond the scope of tonight's discussion, but both Adobe and Microsoft have ebook systems that while they are crawling slowly and tentatively towards creating some accessibility and a broader degree of usability, they essentially are only playable on systems that have decryption software built into them and that probably have decryption for your particular computer built into them.
Audible pretty much works that way also. I think getting back to the discussion of is NLS doing all that it can, and I think we all agree that they can't do, they are. However, possibly there's a fear that on the user end, some of them may be expanding the balloon a little bit or something. It's kind of counterproductive often to prosecute a blind person who might be doing that, and there are some, we're kind of a microcosm of the population, and there are some shady amongst us.
In response, I would say any violator, I have no sympathy for, not only should they be barred from the site, they should be barred from NLS services altogether. Even though I know prisoners are allowed to get NLS services, but I think in order to drive the point home that folks shouldn't be abusing this, that the penalty ought to be stiff.
I wonder how much of this question about the Web Braille may be influencing or may have something long range to do, or how it's going to affect the NLS's research into downloadable audiobooks. I would think there might be some concerns in Washington about how both of all of these are impacted. And personally, I wonder, depending on what happens with the Web Braille, how that's going to impact on the next generation that's going to follow digital talking book.
I find it interesting that I received an email, because I've been beta testing the digital magazine thing with NLS. While I was at CSUN, I received an email, as I'm sure did anyone else who was beta testing the magazines, to find out if you're interested in signing up to be a beta tester for the digital talking books. And they were going to let folks know who was chosen, I believe, by the beginning of May. So I either wasn't chosen, the email got lost, or they're not sure what to do, because I haven't heard any more about that. John made an interesting point about Audible.com and how Audible handles its DRM stuff. And Audible will authorize you to use four players, and they can be the four things of your choice. But that's it. You get four authorizations, and if you need more, you have to call them up, and they will disable one of your existing four. But you can only play an Audible book on four separate devices, and I'm not quite sure how that could translate back to help this situation, but I do find it interesting that they limit you to those four choices.
If we add RFBND into the mix, they essentially encrypt individual machines and require individuals who want to play RFBND audiobooks to have one of those machines that has an encryption key built in, and in addition to know what amounts to a password in the form of a series of numbers, which must be entered into this machine before, in fact, it will play one of these encrypted books.
One of the problems with encryption is I don't know, and I'm kind of new to the PacMate, but I don't know how that would work with PacMates and Braille Notes, which are what a lot of folks are using nowadays for things like web Braille.
See, the fact that Doug raised this whole issue of digital talking books brings us to a question which we are not really going to spend a lot of time on tonight, but I think Doug is absolutely right. The issues that surround web Braille are of consequence to us. The issues that will surround digital talking books, which are actually audiobooks, and which are actually, in some cases, audiobooks that were produced commercially, are going to be entirely different. And I can tell you, as a member of the Digital Long-Term Planning Group, that there are some of us who are fighting for a fairly open platform, but I'm not sure that what's happened recently is going to make that open platform any easier. It used to be that NLS took the position that their job was simply to make the stuff available, and that third-party manufacturers would come into the field just as they did with four-track tape players, to make other versions with other options available to people. I'm not so sure that NLS at the moment is in that same position. What I do know is that NLS will certainly include some sort of encryption, and at the moment, I think it's still up in the air just how exactly that encryption will work and to what degree we will have any ability to utilize other machines than the player that NLS provides. It's an interesting and a fascinating question. Well, let me see if there's one more question or comment that people feel compelled to make. Otherwise, I think we will actually wind this evening down. So the floor is open for final thoughts.
Well, someone had mentioned something about downloading books. Like, I am involved with the Michigan Library for the Blind Consumer Involvement Committee, and there were some ideas of downloading books, from NLS, and that showed great promise. But like we're saying, who knows what the story will tell after a while.
Paul, I want to thank you for this program tonight. I found it very informative and learned a lot. I, for one, never realized that you could download books with web Braille and have them play, say, for instance, with Open Book or even with, say, a Braille and Speak, which I also have. I never knew that. So this was very instructive for me, and certainly there are lots of things to consider here.
Paul, I think one thing that might be helpful is if you could give listeners some suggestions as to what kind of advocacy might be appropriate at this point if folks are concerned about web Braille, and what folks should do to express those concerns in a constructive manner.
ACB has taken the position that people should start writing to their congresspeople. I haven't written to mine yet. In all of the contacts that have recently occurred with Frank Kurtzilke and Judy Dixon, it appears to be pretty carefully and clearly stated that web Braille will be back with us in 10 days to 2 weeks. It seems to me that if, in fact, that's the case, what perhaps we ought to do is two things. The first thing that I think we ought to do is continue to express to NLS our concern about the way that this happened. But the second thing that I would urge us to do is to indicate to NLS just how important this is to us and how many of us are concerned about it, but concerned about it in a constructive way, that is, in wanting it to be back, in recognizing that NLS has some obligations that it needs to deal with, but they also have some obligations to us as their primary users. And one of the obligations that I think they have to us is to treat us in a courteous and an appropriate fashion and to make us a part of the decision-taking that they are having. I think the other thing that I would certainly do is to express pretty clearly to NLS and perhaps even to the Library of Congress that the sudden and unexplained interruption of service is an affront to those of us who use it. Were the service to have gone down for legitimate technical reasons, or were the service to have been discontinued, we who use the service have the right to expect something more than the terse and unhelpful comments that in fact you receive when you sign on.
I mean, this is Bob from Massachusetts. When I first discovered that WebRail was out, I was like, oh, gee, what a drag. I've decided that what I'm going to do is wait 2 weeks and then write to Congress if it isn't back up with letting them know what happened. Incidentally, I must point out that on a leadership message from President Gray, there were indications that Mr. Silkey wasn't really sure if it would be back in 2 weeks and said, hey, it might take up to a year to bring that back. And I certainly hope that isn't the case. But I would say that if it gets beyond 2 weeks, that everybody ought then to be contacting the Congress people.
The note from Mark Maurer had passed out on all of their listservs indicated that Frank Silkey told him 10 days. I'm a little bit curious of the fact that they're as low-key as they are about it, because they usually wouldn't be.
Nevertheless, ladies and gentlemen, I appreciate your having been with us this evening, and I'd really like to thank all of the folks who participated tonight in an unusual version of Tuesday Topics. I think we managed to explore together a pretty complicated issue in some ways that I think shed some new light on just how complex digital rights management is and how hard it is to make easy and good decisions. I think that a number of things came out of tonight's program that deserve some summarizing. The first one is that for those of us who use it, WebRail is an invaluable and wonderful service, and we sincerely hope and expect that it will be back with us soon. Second thing is that in making decisions about how best to operate in a technologically complex environment, it isn't easy for any entity such as NLS to make good decisions. And the third thing that I think has come out, that nevertheless, the way that WebRail was shut down and the somewhat inappropriate attitudes that have been taken to consumers or with consumers is not appropriate. Again, it's been my pleasure to host this exploration of a very complex subject. Thank you for joining us on Tuesday Topics this evening. This is Paul Edwards in Miami, Florida. Next week on Tuesday Topics, we'll explore Braille transcription. How did it start? What has it contributed? And where are we now? What impact have computers and technology had on Braille transcription? To what degree has Braille transcription kept up? How well are we managing to get the stuff that we need in specialized codes like Nemeth or chemistry or music? These topics and more will be a part of next week's Tuesday Topic, Braille Transcription, on ACB Radio, the voice of the blind community.